York, this is Democracy Now!
The enemy knows, and I, as a soldier, tell them that no crime, no terror, and no stupid act will remain unanswered by the Iranian people, and we will severely pursue the criminals. They must know that they will be punished for their actions.
Iran is accusing Israel of assassinating its top nuclear scientist in what many view as an attempt to undercut Joe Biden's chances of reviving the landmark Iran nuclear deal. We'll get the latest. Then, death by firing squad and electrocution? As the Trump administration races to carry out five more executions before Biden takes office, the Justice Department's also trying to expand the ways it can kill prisoners. We'll speak to Sister Helen Prejean, one of the world's most well-known anti-death penalty activists.
Even as states shut down the death penalty, and support by the American people for the death penalty is the lowest it's been in 30 years, there's an unprecedented spate of federal executions at the hand of the Trump administration and Attorney General Barr.
We'll also look at the case of Lisa Montgomery, scheduled to become the first woman to be executed by the federal government in nearly 70 years. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. COVID-19 cases continue to surge across the United States. Hospitalizations have topped 90,000 for the first time. 4 million new cases were recorded in November, double the record set in October, bringing the U.S. death toll to 267,000. Among the dead are over 100,000 residents and staffers at nursing homes. In nine states, more than 1 in 1,000 people have died of coronavirus-related causes since March. Experts are warning the worst is yet to come, and the U.S. could see some 4,000 deaths per day this winter. Post-Thanksgiving holiday travel could also lead to what the government's leading infectious disease expert, Dr. Anthony Fauci, called a superimposed surge as health officials urge any travelers to get tested and take all necessary precautions to limit the spread of COVID-19. In medical news, biotech company Moderna is applying for emergency use authorization from the Food and Drug Administration today, the second vaccine maker after Pfizer and BioNTech to do so. But as drug companies rush to get coronavirus vaccines approved and on the market, doctors and public health experts warn the distribution of COVID-19 vaccines in poorer rural parts of the country will be a major challenge due both to logistical hurdles and mistrust of the medical industry. In legal news, the Supreme Court sided with New York religious groups who are challenging coronavirus restrictions on gatherings. Joe Biden has named the first-ever all-women White House communications team. Jen Psaki, President Obama's former communications director, will serve as White House press secretary. Karine Jean-Pierre, formerly with the political organizing group Move On, will be principal deputy press secretary. Kate Bedingfield, Biden's campaign communications director, will move on to become the White House communications director. Pili Tobar, who previously worked for the immigration reform group America's Voice, will serve as deputy White House communications director. On Vice President Kamala Harris's team, Biden's former campaign advisors Simone Sanders and Ashley Etienne will become chief spokesperson and Harris's communications director, respectively. Biden's also expected to nominate two women of color to key economic positions, Cecilia Rouse, who's African-American, a Princeton labor economist, to chair the Council of Economic Advisors, and Neera Tanden, head of the Center for American Progress, as director of the Office of Management and Budget. Tanden would be the first woman of color and first South Asian woman in the role, but many progressives object to her playing a role in the incoming administration, citing her organization's cozy relationship with corporate funders, her record of antagonizing and undermining progressive Democrats, and her hawkish foreign policy positions. Meanwhile, two alums from the world's largest asset manager, BlackRock, will hold key economic positions. Brian Deese, a current executive at the investment giant, will be Biden's pick for the National Economic Council. And Wally Adeyemo, senior international economic advisor under Obama, will act as Janet Yellen's top deputy at the Treasury Department. Climate activists have condemned the picks due to BlackRock's funding of fossil fuel companies, among other issues. Joe Biden is currently recovering from fracturing his foot this weekend while playing with his dog. President Trump's efforts to overturn the election results appear to be exhausted as he faced a string of defeats over the weekend. Lawsuits in Pennsylvania were rejected, both by the state Supreme Court and a federal appeals court, and a recount in two liberal Wisconsin counties ordered by the Trump campaign cemented Biden's victory there. Trump said for the first time he'll leave office if the Electoral College votes for Joe Biden, even as Trump refuses to concede the election, which Biden won in both the Electoral College and popular votes by wide margins. Trump was questioned by reporters Thursday over his refusal to concede, including by Reuters White House reporter Jeff Mason, who Trump then attacked.
Between you people, don't talk to me that way. You're just a lightweight. Don't talk to me that way. I'm the president of the United States. Don't ever talk to the president that way.
In May, Trump mocked Mason for refusing to take off his mask while asking him a question at a news conference. Meanwhile, Trump has turned on Georgia's Republican Governor Brian Kemp as the state gears up for two Senate runoffs that will determine control of the U.S. Senate. Trump said he was ashamed that he endorsed Kemp as he ranted on Fox News about losing the Georgia vote. Iran held a state funeral today for Mohsen Fazrada, a top nuclear scientist who was assassinated while driving on a highway outside of Tehran Friday. Iran accused Israel of orchestrating the killing, which Iran says may have been conducted by an automatic, remote-controlled machine gun placed inside an empty vehicle. The Iranian president, Hassan Rouhani, said Iran will retaliate at the, quote, proper time.
This brutal and cowardly terror attack showed that our enemies are experiencing weeks of anxiety, weeks when they feel their stress is being reduced and global conditions are changing.
Many analysts say the assassination of the Iranian scientist was designed to make it harder for President-elect Joe Biden to rejoin the landmark 2015 nuclear agreement with Iran, which President Trump withdrew from in 2018. We'll have more on Iran after headlines. Ethiopia's prime minister said Saturday his military had taken complete control of the capital of the northern Tigray region, capping a three-week offensive against separatists that forced tens of thousands to flee to Sudan amidst reports of mass atrocities. Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed, who won the Nobel Peace Prize in 2019, refused international demands for talks with the Tigray People's Liberation Front. Members of that group accused Ethiopia's military of shelling heavily populated areas of the capital, Mekelle. Iran held a state funeral today for Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, the top nuclear scientist who was assassinated while driving on a highway outside of Tehran Friday. Iran accused Israel of orchestrating the killing, which Iran says may have been conducted by an automatic remote-controlled machine gun placed inside an empty vehicle. Iranian President Hassan Rouhani said Iran will retaliate at the, quote, proper time. Many analysts say the assassination of the Iranian scientist was designed to make it harder for Biden to rejoin the landmark 2015 nuclear agreement, which Trump withdrew from. Again, we will have more on this after headlines. A warning to our listeners and viewers, the following two stories contain graphic footage and accounts of violence. In Nigeria, scores of people were killed Saturday as armed men on motorcycles descended on farm workers harvesting rice fields in a rural part of Borno State. The United Nations says at least 110 people were killed in the massacre. At least 30 of the victims were reportedly beheaded. No group has claimed responsibility, but Boko Haram and Islamic Islamic State West Africa province are active in the area. In other news from Nigeria, the Nigerian army has admitted its soldiers were armed with live ammunition when they opened fire on protesters at an October 20th demonstration in Lagos. 12 peaceful protesters were killed in the assault at the Lekki toll gate as they demanded authorities disband the notorious police unit known as SARS, the Special Anti-Robbery Squad. In France, public opposition to a highly contested new security law is mounting after recent high-profile incidents of police violence. The law would ban the publication of images of police officers and increase police powers. Images of French police officers beating black music producer Michel Zecler while hurling racial epithets at him went viral last week. President Emmanuel Macron said the images shamed France. The officers have been suspended and could face charges. On Saturday, the award-winning Syrian photojournalist Amir Alalbi was taken to the hospital with a broken nose and other injuries after police assaulted him while he was covering a protest opposing the new law. The French prime minister said Thursday the wording of the new law would be reviewed. In India, thousands of farmers continue to protest for the fifth straight day against Prime Minister Narendra Modi's move to deregulate agricultural markets. Opponents say the neoliberal policy is a boon to corporations and repeals key labor and farm price protections that could have a devastating impact on the livelihood of farmers. The ongoing protests come after an estimated 250 million workers, farmers, and their allies across India participated Thursday in what's believed to be the largest organized strike in history. In Thailand, protests continue calling for the resignation of the prime minister, democratic reforms, and constraints on the power of the monarchy. Five leaders in the youth-led pro-democracy movement reported to Thai police today as they face charges related to defaming the monarchy. On Sunday, thousands marched to a military barracks where one of the five protest leaders called for military power to come fully under government control.
Control of the king's guard should be brought under the government's rule, the government that the people elected. For the king to have a direct command means intervening in governance and using his excessive power. An army should belong to the people, not the king.
Meanwhile, protesters are warning of a possible military coup attempt, which they say will do everything they can to oppose. Thailand has seen many coups over the years, most recently in 2014, which installed the current prime minister. Maher al-Akras, a Palestinian man who went on a 103-day hunger strike against his imprisonment without charge, was released Thursday by Israeli authorities. He told reporters, quote, "My freedom is the freedom of my people, and we have won over the occupation with our will and determination." Canada banned the export of some medications to the United States before a new rule takes effect today, allowing U.S. pharmacists to import Canadian drugs in bulk. Canada enacted the ban to prevent prescription shortages on its own soil. A major pharmaceutical lobbying group is suing over the new rule, saying the federal government cannot pass off the responsibility of ensuring the safety and cost-effectiveness of imported drugs to state authorities. The Justice Department's issued a new rule that could allow federal executions to take place by firing squad, electrocution, or poison gas starting on December 24th. It's not clear whether any methods other than lethal injection would be used for the three executions scheduled in January after the new rule takes effect. Joe Biden said during campaigning he now supports eliminating the federal death penalty despite previously helping to expand it. We'll have more on this later in the broadcast with the leading anti-death penalty activist, Sister Helen Prejean. In environmental news, the Army Corps of Engineers denied a key permit for the Pebble Mine, likely putting an end to the proposed multi-billion dollar copper and gold mine in Alaska that would have been among the world's largest. The project was determined to be contrary to the public interest and not in compliance with the Clean Water Act. Environmentalists and local indigenous groups have long fought against the Pebble Mine, which they say would have poisoned their communities and devastated Bristol Bay's salmon fishery. President Trump announced on Twitter he pardoned his former national security adviser, Michael Flynn. Flynn has twice pleaded guilty in court to lying to the FBI about his communications with the Russian ambassador to the U.S. in 2016. Flynn also admitted to lying about his lobbying for Turkey, which a Biden administration Justice Department could still decide to pursue. And thousands of Amazon workers participated in a global action block Friday to demand fairer wages, hazard pay during the pandemic, and for the retail behemoth to start paying taxes. Social and climate justice groups are also joined the Make Amazon Pay actions, which took place across 15 countries, including the U.S., Mexico, Brazil, the Philippines, Germany, and Poland. Protesters are also demanding Amazon commit to better environmental practices and to allow workers to unionize. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Iran's top nuclear scientist was assassinated while driving on a highway outside of Tehran on Friday. Iran accused Israel of orchestrating the killing of Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, who reportedly led Iran's nuclear program. A state funeral was held today in Tehran, where photographs of him were displayed next to Iranian commander Qasem Soleimani, who was assassinated by a U.S. drone strike in Baghdad 10 months ago. The Iranian defense minister, Amir Hatami, spoke at the funeral.
The enemy knows, and I, as a soldier, tell them that no crime, no terror, and no stupid act will remain unanswered by the Iranian people, and we will severely pursue the criminals. They must know that they will be punished for their actions. The criminal United States has thousands of nuclear weapons, and the criminal Zionist regime has hundreds of nuclear weapons. What are these weapons for? Are these weapons for use as decor in your home?
Iran's foreign minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif, has described the killing of the top nuclear scientist as an act of state terror. Conflicting details have emerged about how he died. Iranian state media initially said gunmen ambushed his car in the countryside. But now, a top Iranian official says he was killed by an automatic, remote-controlled machine gun placed inside an empty vehicle. Israel's long been accused of targeting Iranian nuclear scientists. Between 2010 and 2012, four Iranian nuclear scientists were assassinated. Many analysts say Friday's assassination was designed to make it harder for President-elect Joe Biden to rejoin the landmark 2015 nuclear agreement with Iran, which President Trump withdrew from in 2018. The assassination comes just weeks after Trump privately inquired if he could bomb Iran's main nuclear site prior to leaving office. Iran has long maintained its nuclear program is for peaceful purposes. Earlier this month, international inspectors reported Iran's low enriched uranium stockpile is growing again, but that the uranium is being enriched at a level suitable for nuclear power plants, not nuclear weapons. We go now to Nagar Mortazavi. She's an Iranian-American journalist and political analyst, host of the Iran podcast. We welcome you to Democracy Now! Can you start off, Nagar, by talking about the significance of this assassination, what's understood at this point, and then the fact that Iran is accusing Israel, and Israel has not commented?
Good morning, Amy. Sure. As you said, this is not the first nuclear scientist in Iran being assassinated. Israel has always denied involvement, but it's really the only country with both the motivation and the capability to conduct such attacks. Mohsen Fakhrizadeh was a top person in the nuclear and defense infrastructure of Iran. He was well guarded. The country knew that he was a target. Benjamin Netanyahu, Israeli prime minister, had named him 2 years ago in a presentation. He said, remember this name, Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. So the security services knew that he would be a potential target for the Israelis. He was well guarded. And the fact that this operation was successfully launched, it was first said that there was an ambush. Now there's talks of an automatic weapon. We're still not sure how exactly it unfolded, but it was successful, and he's dead now. It's just the blow to Iran's security system. And it's also, I believe, it's a political move to first try to provoke Iran into a violent retaliation and basically pull Iran into a wider military conflict with the United States, and then also complicate future negotiations between Tehran and Washington when President-elect Biden enters office, which I think this will complicate those future negotiations.
So can you talk about whether you believe the United States is involved with this, too? As I just pointed out, we did report earlier that President Trump had asked his top military officials if they could bomb Natanz, the nuclear site in Iran, before he leaves office. But what kind of complicity do you feel there was complicity here?
I mean, it's hard to say for sure, and we haven't heard any confirmation from Israel or the United States, but it's important to note that there has been some travel back and forth by Mike Pompeo to the region. He's been meeting with the Israelis, with the Saudis, with the Emiratis. And this was the same pattern last year, right before the assassination of Iranian commander Qasem Soleimani. There was also some traveling back and forth and meetings between Mike Pompeo and the Trump administration's close allies in the Middle East. We don't know. I'm not sure if we're ever going to know, but I wouldn't rule it out that this was at least done with a green light and approval of the Trump administration by the Israelis. You know, the Trump administration, President Trump's orbit, especially someone like Mike Pompeo, he's been always looking for a military confrontation with Iran or a strike on Iran's nuclear sites. And this is their final weeks in the office. So I wouldn't rule it out if this came at least with a nod or approval from the United States.
And so talk about how Iran is responding inside, across the political spectrum, and those like Rouhani who recognize that as Trump comes the end of his term and at all levels, domestically and internationally, is trying to reinforce what he has done, whether we're talking about, you know, withdraw from the climate accord and try to prevent Joe Biden from rejoining, to withdraw from the Iranian nuclear deal. This is the Iranian President Hassan Rouhani speaking following the assassination.
This brutal and cowardly terror attack showed that our enemies are experiencing weeks of anxiety, weeks when they feel their stress is being reduced and global conditions are changing. The relevant authorities will respond to this crime in a timely and appropriate manner.
And I'd like to go back to 2018, when the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu called out Fakhrizadeh as the director of Iran's nuclear weapons project and urged people to, quote, remember that name.
Iran devised a plan to do two things. First, to preserve the nuclear know-how from Project Ahmad. And second, to further develop its nuclear weapons-related capabilities. That plan came directly from Iran's top leadership. A key part of the plan was to form new organizations to continue the work. This is how Dr. Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, head of Project Ahmad, put it. Remember that name, Fakhrizadeh.
Your response, Nagar.
Well, let me first clarify that the nuclear or the weapons-related part of Iran's program, the Ahmad program, was stopped somewhere around 2003, and this is the UN watchdog, the IAEA, even U.S. State Department reports have confirmed that Iran no longer has a weapons-related program. So this is something that Benjamin Netanyahu alleges, but other international entities haven't confirmed it. But it's there is a national debate basically ongoing in Iran on one main argument is that because Iran doesn't retaliate, if Iran does not respond to such an assassination, to Israeli, basically target Israeli target, this type of assassination will continue with impunity, because we see how Israel has been carrying these out with a sort of impunity. There's another argument, sort of the opposite argument, more of the pro-diplomacy camp, that is recognizing that this might be a trap set by Netanyahu to basically prevent future diplomacy, to pull Iran into a military conflict, and that Iranians should be aware and not take the bait. And this is something I recognize in President Rouhani's statements. We hear sort of the same line from Javad Zarif. And that camp, the pro-diplomacy camp, is more expecting condemnation from the international community. They haven't been very happy from statements that came from the European Union. They weren't very strong statements. They expect the international community to call this what it is, an assassination, terrorism, and to condemn it in with strong condemnation. So that would give, if such condemnations continue to come from the international community, would give strengthen that argument that Iran shouldn't act rash and retaliate in a way that Netanyahu has been trying to provoke Iran. But there's also talks of, a harsh revenge, retaliation, and as the Supreme Leader also said, punishment for the perpetrators of this assassination.
And which side do you think will prevail within Iran?
I don't think that the retaliation will be that provocative. The president has said it would be done in a timely manner, so it means that it could, they could drag it. And if they do drag it, the only silver lining of this event could be that Iran can use this as leverage when the Biden administration comes in to be like, look, the pro-diplomacy camp can go to the table with Biden and say, look, we've dragged the hardliners until now, we've stopped them, we've contained them, but you got to make this deal pretty fast before, time runs out. Because we've heard from the Biden camp also, people in Joe Biden's orbit, that maybe the sanctions put on by the Trump administration should be used as leverage when negotiations with Iran happen, and to delay a return to the nuclear deal, which I don't think is a good idea. I think the Biden administration should prioritize return to diplomacy, to the nuclear deal, and make it fast and clean to then continue follow-on negotiations beyond the JCPOA.
And what about the idea that the IMEU is putting forward, the Institute for Middle East Understanding? On December 27, 2008, Israel launched Operation Castlet, a massive 22-day military assault on the Gaza Strip. The ferocity of the attack was unprecedented in the more than six-decade-old conflict between Israelis and Palestinians, killing some 1,400 Palestinians, most of them civilian. In the aftermath of the offensive, a UN-appointed fact-finding mission found strong evidence of war crimes and crimes against humanity committed by both the Israeli military and Palestinian militias. Investigations by human rights groups such as Amnesty and Human Rights Watch came to the same conclusion. This also a critical period where you had Barack Obama elected, but he was just about to take office, and a tremendous amount of attention was being paid to that, as in this lame duck period in the United States.
I agree. I think there can be some similarities drawn and some comparisons made. The case between Iran and Israel is a little bit different because we already have a deal in place with the United States. Under Barack Obama, when negotiations were still ongoing, when a deal was potentially to be made, Netanyahu tried everything possible to provoke Iran, to prevent negotiations. He even came here to Washington, made a speech at the U.S. Congress trying to prevent the nuclear negotiations from succeeding, and he failed. But right now with the Biden administration, I think the strength of this administration's policy in Iran would be that there's already a deal in place, and the Iranians are still abiding by it to some extent, and there are other parties, it was a multilateral deal, who are still in the deal. So that makes it easier for the incoming administration to rejoin and to basically continue this diplomacy with Iran, and it makes it harder and more complicated for Israel to try to sabotage the return to the deal and future diplomacy. But I think these are ways that Netanyahu has used in the past to try to provoke, to try to sabotage, and he will probably continue. I don't think this would be the last one. There's still 7 weeks till the end of the Trump presidency, and I wouldn't be surprised if we see other events coming up in the next.
And we just have 30 seconds. But the effect of the massive set of sanctions that President Trump cumulatively has put in place at this point on the people of Iran?
It's been the main Foremost pressure is on the Iranian people. The civil society is impacted, working classes, middle classes. The ordinary Iranians are the ones who are paying the price for us, the price for some real life necessities, food, medicine. Some life-saving medicine is rare to find, is scarce. So it's the main pressure has been on the Iranian people. And any kind of military conflict will also have the main casualties will be civilians, as we saw when Iran tried to retaliate for the assassination of Qasem Soleimani. They turned around and shot Ukrainian airliner over Iran, and any kind of retaliation or military conflict will eventually have the casualty will be civilians in Iran or across the region.
Of course, this all coming at the time of the pandemic. Nigar Murtazavi, I want to thank you very much for being with us, Iranian-American journalist and political analyst, host of the Iran podcast. Up next, death by firing squad, poison gas, or electrocution? As the Trump administration races to carry out five more executions before Biden takes office, the Justice Department is trying to expand the number of ways it can kill prisoners. We'll be joined by Sister Helen Prejean. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, the Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Death by firing squad, electrocution, or poison gas? Under a new rule filed by the Trump administration, these methods can now be used to carry out executions for federal death sentences in addition to lethal injection. The amendment to the Manner of Federal Executions rule was entered Friday into the Federal Register, goes into effect Christmas Eve. That's December 24th. This comes as the Trump administration's already executed eight people in the past 5 months. Earlier this month, it executed Orlando Hall at the federal penitentiary in Terre Haute, Indiana. Hall was an African-American man sentenced to die by an all-white jury. Prior to this year, the federal government had not executed anyone since 2003, 17 years ago. Now, in what critics say is a dramatic deviation from historical practices, five more people are scheduled to be executed during Trump's final weeks in office, three of them just days before President-elect Joe Biden is inaugurated, including the first woman in nearly 70 years. The Death Penalty Information Center reports it's been more than a century since a federal execution was conducted during a lame duck presidency in 1889 during the outgoing administration of Grover Cleveland. The Justice Department has not yet said whether it will try to use any methods other than lethal injection for the three executions it's scheduled after the new rules take effect. President-elect Joe Biden said during the election campaign he now supports eliminating the federal death penalty. Biden co-authored legislation in 1990 that expanded the federal death penalty. For more, we're joined by Sister Helen Prejean, one of the world's most well-known anti-death penalty activists, the author of the best-selling book Dead Man Walking, An Eyewitness Account of the Death Penalty, her most recent book River of Fire, My Spiritual Journey. Also with us, Sandra Babcock, faculty director of the Cornell Center on the Death Penalty Worldwide. We welcome you both back to Democracy Now! Sister Helen Prejean, let's begin with you. This was filed on Friday that the Trump administration, that the federal government can kill prisoners, expanding it to poison gas, firing squad, or electrocution? Can you respond?
I think the reason they're doing that is they want to make sure that they can expedite these executions without any court cases about lethal injection. There have been questions about lethal injection, the drugs that are used. This is the fault of the Supreme Court, by the way, which has allowed states to just experiment widely with drugs to kill people, which has resulted in botched executions. It may also come from the fact that autopsy reports, 200 of them, of those who've been lethally injected, show that there was a massive amount of fluid in their lungs, which meant they were drowning. I think it's the callous brute force of the mentality of the Trump administration, that he just believes that he can use force and kill people. He can use violence and force to make his point. There's no need for these executions to happen. To me, it just reveals a fundamental flaw which has been built into the death penalty from the time that the Supreme Court put death back in 1976. And here's the fundamental flaw, and the federal executions we're seeing now really exemplifies it. There was a weak criteria that only the worst of the worst should be killed, and nobody really knows what that means. And so there's been wide latitude in interpreting worst of the worst, or even the assumption that out of all the ordinary murders, whatever that means, there's some who can be targeted as, but this is the worst of the worst. So with a weak criteria, it's coupled with that you give complete discretion to pursue death to the prosecutors. It's a fact that if prosecutors do not seek death, people don't die from executions. So here you have now in the jurisdiction of the federal government, Attorney General Barr, who has the power to seek death and pursuing it. All he had to do was get a signal from Trump, we're going to start killing people. And there's been no way to stop him. So the fundamental flaw is a weak, fuzzy criteria that was never clear in the first place, coupled with discretion of prosecutors. And it exemplifies exactly why we need to shut the death penalty down. You can't let frail, politically driven individuals decide you and you are going to die for whatever political objective they have in mind.
Sandra Babcock, if you can also respond to the Trump administration quietly attempting to expand the ways they can kill prisoners to poison gas, electrocution, and firing squad.
You know, it is a paroxysm of violence that we're seeing right now. And one of the things that is so hard to digest is that the people that they are choosing to subject to these methods of execution are not, as Sister Helen just said, the worst of the worst. They are the most broken of the broken. And Lisa Montgomery is a good example of that. She is somebody the federal government intends to execute on January 12th. And she was a victim of incest, of gang rape, of child sex trafficking, of unimaginable violence for her entire life before she committed the crime for which she was sentenced to death. She is profoundly mentally ill. She began to dissociate when she was a teenager, when her father, her stepfather, built her a special room off the side of their trailer so he and his buddies could go in and rape her. Her mother sold her to the plumber and to the electrician, told her that she had to earn her keep. And so she obtained services after these men raped Lisa. And Lisa was left from these experiences as somebody who has the most fragile grip on reality because she had to escape from her reality in order to survive. This is the kind of person that William Barr intends to put to death in January why the rush to execute someone like Lisa Montgomery among all of these other people? That, to me, illustrates the brutality of what we are witnessing right now.
And this would be the first woman executed in 70 years. The examples of her own life history not brought up at the trial. Why?
Well, they weren't brought up because she was represented by a male defense team that had never been trained and didn't know how to interview a woman. She was left curled in a fetal position on the floor of her prison cell during one of the interviews, a couple of the interviews that her male lawyer conducted with her. And so the jury never heard about the scope of her abuse or the impact that it had. And the prosecutors trivialized it. They called it the abuse excuse. This is not an excuse. Anyone who has been the victim of sexual violence and the kind of sexual torture that Lisa Montgomery endured knows that this is not something that can be trivialized. This has lifelong consequences. And for Lisa, it meant that she is somebody who is broken. She is the most broken of the broken. She is somebody who has a very difficult time understanding what is real and what is not because of what she endured. And so the people who were supposed to defend her did not do their job. And as a result, she is now scheduled to be executed at a time for a crime that no other woman has ever been executed for in this entire country. We know that there are at least 16 women who have committed very similar crimes. And prosecutors in those cases recognize that these are crimes that are the product of trauma and mental illness. But the federal government under Albert Gonzalez decided that they were going to seek the death penalty in this case. She really is unique, and she really is not the kind of person the death penalty was intended for.
Even former prosecutors are saying she should not be put to death.
That's right. There's a number of former prosecutors have come forward, former sex crimes prosecutors, people who have tried to put away the criminals who raped Lisa. And no one ever intervened to help Lisa. Her sister was taken out of the home, but Lisa was left there.
Let me read the letter sent to President Trump by more than 40 current and former prosecutors in support of Lisa Montgomery. They write, quote, "Our experience prosecuting human traffickers and those who commit sex crimes against children has given us a unique understanding of the profound physical and psychological harm that victims like Lisa suffer. In this case, mental health professionals have concluded the sexual violence and cruelty she suffered was directly related to the crime she committed. They've also diagnosed Lisa with organic brain damage and serious mental illness that requires her to be heavily medicated at all times. A history of being victimized is not an abuse excuse, as the jury was told at her trial. We view this kind of evidence as critically relevant to determining the appropriate punishment for a serious crime." Again, that was a letter written by former prosecutors.
That's right. And there was also a letter from two prosecutors who had prosecuted women for virtually identical crimes, who also said these are crimes that are committed by women who are profoundly mentally ill. And we recognize that. And that's why we did not seek the death penalty in those cases. So this is a really different case, Amy. We don't see these kinds of people coming out and calling for commutation, calling for mercy. We don't see anti-violence activists, the people who have spent their entire lifetimes combating domestic violence committed against women, child sex trafficking, the kind of people who have spent their lives fighting against child sex traffickers, are coming out because these are the people who know what damage this does to a child and to a person who has survived this. It is lifelong trauma that cannot be overcome without the kind of counseling that Lisa Montgomery never received. And she is now very mentally ill. Her mental illness is controlled by a complex regimen of antipsychotic medication. But since she learned of her execution date, her mental health is deteriorating daily. They took away her underwear after she was told that she had an execution date, which for a trauma survivor, a sexual violence, somebody who is a victim of sexual violence, put her over the edge. She has been told that she's going to be transferred to an all-male prison where she will be executed there. She cannot even be in a room with a man without breaking out into hives. And they intend to transfer her to an all-male prison. That in itself is torture. Beyond, you know, even setting aside the government's plans to subject people to poison gas, even if you take Lisa Montgomery to an all-male prison to subject her to lethal injection, that is torture. This woman has been tortured her entire life. And all that we are asking for is that her sentence be commuted to life imprisonment without the possibility of parole.
Now, she was sentenced after the killing of and convicted of a 23-year-old, 8-month pregnant woman. And explain what she did.
So she killed Bobbie Jo Stinnett, a woman who was pregnant. And this what came after Lisa herself had been subjected to a coerced sterilization procedure by her stepbrother, whom she had married at her mother's instigation. And she was pressured into this sterilization when she was very mentally ill. After that happened, her mental illness became worse and worse until she was completely psychotic. And in the grips of this psychosis, she befriended Bobbie Jo Stinnett. She killed her. She carved the fetus out of the woman's abdomen, and she took it home and pretended that it was her own child and cared for the fetus, cared for the baby as if it were her own baby. This is the kind of crime that is so unbelievably tragic, and nothing that I'm saying diminishes that tragedy. But we have to understand that a crime like this cannot be separated from Lisa Montgomery's experiences as a profoundly mentally ill person who was involuntarily sterilized and who was brutalized for her entire life. This is not an abuse excuse, as the prosecutor said. This is an explanation. This helps us to understand why she did what she did. And again, we're not asking that she not be punished. We are saying that this is not the kind of person who should be exterminated from the human race.
We're going to break and then come back to this discussion. I want to thank Sandra Babcock for joining us, faculty director of the Cornell Center on the Death Penalty Worldwide. And we'll continue with Sister Helen Prejean. We'll be looking at the four other executions that are scheduled. Again, five executions scheduled in the lame duck period between presidencies. The last time this happened was over a century ago. Stay with us.
Back when the terrors and the nightmares had their start, by two or three or four, I felt it fall apart. Should have held my hand. They should have held my hand. I tried to stay inside and run away from you. But then she sold my body, mouth and legs and skin. And man by man, they killed me, forcing themselves in.
Lisa's song by Veronica Sinibuk about Lisa Montgomery, who is facing federal execution on January 12th. The execution was put off because her lawyers had COVID. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we look further at the unprecedented five federal executions, President Trump's Justice Department is scheduled before Inauguration Day. On December 10th, that's International Human Rights Day, the federal government plans to kill a 40-year-old black man named Brandon Bernard. He was 18 years old when he was allegedly an accomplice to a murder of a young white couple. During his trial, his attorneys did not make opening statements. At the penalty stage, they called no witnesses. Out of the 12 jurors, all but one was white. Now, five of the jurors say they think Bernard should not be executed. A former assistant U.S. attorney who helped secure his death sentence wrote in the Indianapolis Star, quote, "Executing Brandon would be a terrible stain on the nation's honor." That's one of the prosecutors who prosecuted him. On the day after Bernard is set to die, Alfred Bourgeois, another black man, is scheduled to be federally executed December 11th. As we reported, January 12th, Lisa Montgomery is scheduled to be the first woman executed by the federal government in nearly 70 years. The Trump administration has rejected her request for a reprieve. On January 14th, Corey Johnson, another black man, is set to be put to death. According to Johnson's attorneys, he has an IQ of 69, which means he's below the standard the Supreme Court used to determine if an execution would be cruel and unusual punishment. And on January 15th, Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday, the federal government's expected to execute Dustin Higgs, another black man who was sentenced to die for his role in the murder of three women, even though he did not kill them, under the so-called law of parties theory. For more, we continue with Sister Helen Prejean, one of the world's most well-known anti-death penalty activists. Sister Helen Prejean, if you can comment on this unprecedented, not in 100 years, has a lame duck administration executed one, let alone five prisoners in this period?
It just shows when you give absolute power over life and death to government officials, they can really do what they want. One interesting thing about Grover Cleveland and the, you know, the lame duck time when he executed people, he had once been a sheriff in Erie, New York, and carried out execution. So he had it in his blood. And then for this to happen, it's just, see, I've accompanied six people to execution. It's this absolute power to take a human being who's alive and make these inscrutable decisions all along the way. As I was mentioning earlier, first of all, to even assume that out of all the murderers, you're going to be able to pinpoint the worst of the worst, either by their character, by their very nature, they are evil people, or by what they have done to determine they are in a special category all their own. And you can distinguish them, and then to believe that you can set up a system of the jury, the trial, and the basic flaw in all these things is that at trial, you're supposed to have an adversarial way of coming to truth. So you have prosecutors that present, there's forensic evidence, here's the scenario of the crime, but you're supposed to have defense that's supposed to be able to say to this jury, decide the whole story of the person who did the crime. You always have to look at culpability, like Lisa Montgomery, culpability of someone who's psychotic, who was brutalized and tortured her whole life. And then to pinpoint the identifying her by the crime that she should be killed. It's so flawed. And the suffering is so great. And here's the thing. Here's why I wrote Dead Man Walking. And here's why I just wrote River of Fire, about waking up to these injustices and then being an active citizen doing something about it. All this is a secret ritual. The public is not going to be anywhere near and cannot be near Lisa Montgomery and what she's suffering now, what it's going to mean when she's put in an all-male prison. If we didn't have people like Democracy Now!, if we didn't have the media, if we didn't have activists and witnesses in there seeing these things, the people would just go, oh, that's a terrible crime. She deserves to die. It's such a superficial, thin-souled way of approaching a deeply moral issue. So what we, you and I, what we're doing now in bringing the public close to this, and that we got to find an alternative, which in fact the people are doing. We are shutting down the death penalty in states. We're down to 2% of counties where prosecutors still somewhat go after the death penalty, side by side with other prosecutors who never go for it because it's up to the discrepancy of the person to choose death or not. Take Brandon Bernard. I've gotten involved with this case. And just two times now, I've been able to be on conference calls with him and with his lawyers trying to save his life. And he described, this would be like three Fridays ago. So he's grown up on death row in Terre Haute. He was just 18 when the crime happened. Has expressed remorse. Can't even imagine. He was just a young kid when this crime happened of these people being killed. And he did play some part in it, but anybody who knows Brandon knows he would never have consented to killing people as what happened. At his trial, supposedly an expert on future dangerousness, which has widely been debunked now as totally unpredictable, the jury was told that he was a leader of a gang. He wasn't the leader. He was a low guy on the totem pole. So they have an image of him as this mastermind, this leader who gave all the directions for these people being killed. And let's get back to three or four Fridays ago. It's a regular day in his life. He gets along with everybody at the prison.
We just have 30 seconds, Sister Helen.
Anyway, they come, two guards come to his door. They don't say a word. He usually jokes with them. They put handcuffs on him, walking down the hall where the warden's waiting and says, here's the warrant for your death. You'll be dead by this date. And of course, he, then his whole life, it's torture. It's unseen. We have to get the word out and to the American people, shut this down.
Sister Helen, before we go, I wanted to ask you about someone else who you have worked with over the years, Bill Pelkey, the anti-death penalty activist who died earlier this month at the age of 73, co-founded the group Journey of Hope, partnered with you to campaign against the death penalty on May 14th, 85. His grandmother, Ruth Pelkey, was murdered by then 15-year-old Paula Cooper. Paula was later convicted and sentenced to death, making her the youngest person on death row. Pelkey was among those who pleaded for her life to be spared. In 2013, Bill Pelkey spoke on Democracy Now.
But I knew immediately when my heart was touched with that compassion and forgiveness took place, I knew from that moment on, whenever I would think about my grandmother again, I would no longer picture how she died, but I would picture how she lived, what she stood for, what she believed in, the beautiful, wonderful person she was. And I knew it wasn't something that happened just so I'd feel good for a period of time, but it was something to be shared with other people.
So that was Bill Pelkey on Democracy Now! With you in 2013. In fact, he was able to help get Paula Cooper off of death row, although she would ultimately take her own life. Your final thoughts in this last 20 seconds, Sister Helen Prejean.
Bill Pelkey is one more example of someone who, instead of being dehumanized by violence that happened to his beloved grandmother, took that courage that she had and brought it into life, and he fought for it his whole life to end the death penalty. He was the one waiting for Paula Cooper when she was released from prison, and it played such a role because he believed in life and that all human beings could be redeemed.
Sister Helen Prejean, I thank you so much for being with us, one of the world's most well-known anti-death penalty activists. And as we end today's show, a very happy birthday to Dina Guzder. Democracy Now! Produced with Renee Felsmeyer, Dina Guzder, Libby Rainey, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Carla Wills, Tammy Warrenoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari A. Studio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Honey Masood, and Adriana Contreras. Special thanks to Julie Crosby. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.